Alchemy. Like obsessions, paper aeroplanes land in some funny places. As a child, I made darts and gliders and decided for myself which flew best. I had a purpose: to achieve the minute-long flight, every fold perfected through the crafting of hundreds. In my mind, only one has never landed.
And the first one is called The Advantages of Chocolate. I read somewhere that chocolate triggers the same chemical reaction in the brain as sex. Chocolate has many advantages. It's easily available and can be consumed in circumstances where sex would be frowned on or even impossible. Whilst driving a car, for instance, or cleaning the windows. And of course, chocolate will remain hard indefinitely if kept in the fridge.
Registers. Out of the warm primordial cave of our conversations, Jack's gone. No more chit-chat under the blankets, pegged over chairs and nipped in drawers. Throughout his first 5 years, an ear always open, at worst ajar, I catch myself still listening out for sounds of him in the sensible house, where nothing stirs but the washing machine, which clicks and churns. I'm loosening his arms clasped round my neck, detaching myself from his soft, protracted kiss goodbye. Good boy, diminishing down the long corridors into the huge, unknown assembly hall. Each word strange, even his name on Miss Cracknell's tongue. That was what she was called. It's a gift, isn't it?
There was such undertaking. He sat on the back doorstep shelling peas, sprinkling them in fives and sixes to float in a white bowl. She hummed inside, her arms in flower. Married 2 years, home a remote cottage cluster beyond wheat fields and woods, their families 3 hours bike ride away, each was beginning to know the other. He cycled early to the station every day. At 6, from the table, she heard him ring his bell, looked up to see the slow rotating wave, and poured tea. That Sunday, the wireless was on. Chamberlain, enunciating cracklingly, brought him to her, some fat pods in one hand. This country is at war with Germany. He wrote of aeroplanes and Nissen huts, Doncaster, Andover, food and friends. He sent love. 6 winters she cleared the paths of snow, laundered for one, and sewed at dusk when Wellington skimmed the far trees. The day his heels clicked again on the road, she dropped the knife and the apple and ran. She hears news sometimes of an overthrow, African deaths, tanks, mines, then wipes her hands of flour and switches off the radio.
This is called Voyage of Discovery. Centuries of tradition, coupled with my mother's own example, instilled an anxiety to please, to abase myself, subordinate ambition for expediency. And how the biological bit, that joker in this pack of thieves, stretched out the scenario, putting me down in the missionary position of pious acquiescence. More shameful to admit, the aforesaid biological bit actually wallowed in its stereotype. Now the life force leaves me, beached and belly uppermost, I discover, without surprise or rancor, one powerful difference. No one's waiting in the wings to drown me. And that's bad news.
The film extras wish. What every scene leaves me with is only a standing still. A pause before life resumes, beyond actions I fulfill. Part of a massing army, or someone just passing by who adds to a busy street. My voice mostly a crowd's cry. Far away from all the sets, I'm playing a leading role in the betrayal of love. An affair which takes its toll and creates in me a wish to become no more to her than someone just passing by who appears as a blur.
How long ago was it when he made a start on sharing with his public the brilliance of his art? It seems like half a lifetime since he took the stage, but every time you hope he's done, he turns another page. Is no one going to tell him, or he might read until you drop, that the craft he needs to master is knowing when? Thank you.
For a start, I was having to carry my keyboard with me. The combined weight of this keyboard and its carrying case was just about as much as my arms could bear. We would be rehearsing straight after work that night, and I wouldn't have time to come back to the flat, so I had no option but to carry this monstrous thing with me all the way to the shop. Out on the estate, the first thing I saw was a bunch of kids, who should all have been on their way to school, throwing bricks at a bicycle. They all had skinhead haircuts and stonewashed jeans, and they jeered and shouted obscenities at me as I struggled past with my keyboard. "Look at that fucking wimp," they shouted. I couldn't really disagree with them. They all looked about 10 times stronger than me. On this estate, I'd once seen 2 8-year-old children lift up a concrete bollard and hurl it through the window of Ford Fiesta. As I staggered past the grocers and the chip shop, I realized there was no way I could carry the keyboard for more than another 10 yards. I'd been walking for 5 minutes, and I had another 1.25 miles to go to the tube station. My face was purple. I was sweating profusely, and I was gasping for breath. I dropped the keyboard on the ground, sat down on it, and buried my head in my hands. After a while, I tried to pick it up again. I couldn't. It was as if it was glued to the pavement. I sat down again and rested. One of my neighbours, several months pregnant, pushing a pram and with a small child in a harness on her back, came past and offered to carry it for me for a while. I politely refused. There was a call box nearby. I knew I was going to have to phone for a minicab. It was a dismal morning, misty and wet, and I sat on the pavement shivering and rubbing my hands as I waited for the cab to arrive. 10 minutes later, an old beige Rover 2000 pulled up beside me. "Cheapside, wasn't it?" said the driver, a middle-aged man with greased back hair and a string vest showing beneath his nylon shirt. "That's right," I said, getting up. He looked at my keyboard. "Is that yours?" "Yeah." "Can't take that, mate. No way." "What? You should have told me you wanted an estate or something. No way I'm taking that thing. No bleeding way." "Well, I'm sure it would fit on the back seat. Back seat's for passengers, mate. This is a passenger vehicle, not a bleeding removal van. Do you know what that would do to my upholstery? Well, maybe if we try the boot. Have a look at that upholstery. Go on, have a look." I opened the back door and looked inside. "Very nice. Do you know how much that cost me? 60 quid. 60 quid that cost me. If you think I'm going to fuck that up with heavy objects, you've got another thing coming, mate." "Well, I see your point. Should have cost twice that, of course, but this mate of mine, see, he did it cheap. Anyway, I could be sacked if I start doing removals. More than my job's worth, that is." "Okay, look, forget it. 6 quid minimum it'll cost you if I'm going to take that big fucker in the back of my car. Where was it you wanted to go? Cheapside? Well, that's the other side of the river, isn't it? That's another fiver just to start with." "Don't worry. I'll get there some other way." "I'm not worried, mate. I'm not worried. You're the one that should be bleeding worried. Of course, I shall have to charge you 350 just for calling me out. If you told the bloke on the phone you wanted the contents of your house removing, you could have saved us all a lot of trouble. What are you going to do now, then? Catch a bus?" "Well, yeah, I suppose so. Nearest bus stop's half a mile away, isn't it? Anyway, no driver's going to let you on with that thing, are they? You know what I think, mate? I think you're well and truly fucked. Have you got one of our cards?" He gave me a card with the name of the firm and a telephone number on it and then drove off. I don't know how I did it, but I staggered into work and arrived 3/4 of an hour late. Nobody said anything.
One that was published in Sunk Island called Weatherwise. I said to him, "You know, the rain has hardly stopped the last 3 days." He said that in Patagonia there are shrews that excrete perfume so divine that bees are drawn from natural flowers to the shrew's sable tongue for it to steal the golden harvest. I said, "Maybe it will clear up this afternoon." He said, "In Kuala Lumpur, some nights the frogs achieve such pitches that their songs burst amber jars of rice wine and fruit flies get drunk. Frogs feed insatiably, the lizards do." I said the greenhouse effect will melt the ice. He said that in northeast Australia, crocodiles have a special penchant for the blues, and if you play Miles Davis to the setting sun, they turn white bellies to the rising stars and greet the tropic night with little grunts and purrs. I said that in Estonia there are wolves that gather every Candlemas to hold a howling, and their music causes bears insomnia, but passing caribou react differently and dream erotica. He said, "I think you're right about the rain."
The first hit's magic, bliss. It's like this dark space opens up at the back of your brain. You can go and hide there. No pressure. I go into schools, stoned sometimes, just to help me cope. Bullying goes on, though. I don't know if it's better or worse, because now I'm spending a lot of time in this dark, peaceful place. Only, the magic starts to fade after the first few hits. And all the money I make goes straight back into buying stuff. It isn't always enough. I start to get worried about what's happening to me. There's another Pakistani lad in my class. He doesn't bully me, and sometimes he gets the others to lay off. I decide to tell him. I'm guarded, not saying how much I take, how much I sell. He knows how dangerous my employers are. He will understand. I tell him. He says he'll keep silent if I give him £5. I give it to him, and more. But word gets around anyway. It's like a joke in the class. Ali's on drugs! None of them really believe it. It's just another way to get at me, that's all. Teachers here, but they don't do anything. I'm not the type. Well, they just don't care. I need help. I can't afford all the stuff I need now. I sell some of the clothes I bought. Clothes don't interest me anymore. I take money from the till in the shop, money my family can't afford. I still can't get as much as I need. In English, there's this new teacher. He started for the summer term, my third year. He's soft. Lets the kids talk a lot. In lessons, he tries to get me to join in. I stay silent. Other kids call out, "Don't ask Ali, sir. He's on drugs." He ignores them, but later he asks me, "Is there anything in what they say? Tell me now, I won't get you into trouble." I feel the other kids looking at me as I talk to him. My face burns. He's easy to lie to. No, they're just getting at me. They always get at me. Why haven't you done your homework? Forgot. Do something for next lesson. Anything. Just make up a story. But I can't. When he collects the books next lesson, I hide my face. The others joke. Ali never does homework, sir. He looks at me with regret. In English, the next week, we're doing poetry. Learning poems. Making them up. Writing them out. I sit in a corner, pretending to read. The teacher comes over, asks me to read to him. I won't. Kids call out, mocking me. Later, he comes back. In his hand is a book of poems and a new tape recorder, a tiny battery one with micro cassettes like journalists use. "I brought this in," he says. "Take it off somewhere, find a poem you like, record it for me." He shows me how. "Come back by the end of the lesson," adding, "Make up something of your own if you like." I walk off. The space at the back of my head is an aching hole. I need to fill it. There are no school markings on the machine. It must belong to the teacher. If I took it to someone I know, he'd give me 15, maybe 20 pounds for it. I wander around the school. I'm not supposed to do this, but the teacher said I could, so he's the one who'll get into trouble. I can make up some story about what happened to his cassette. I can make enough money for two fixes. I'm in the big hall. I could go through the fire escape and out to the bike sheds. I could ride into town. Instead, I sit down, almost hiding myself behind one of the big blue curtains. I open the book and begin to read the first poem I found. It's difficult, and I have to pause the tape many times before I finish it. Some of the words, I have to guess how to pronounce them. There are no rhymes. The book's by Alfred Lord Tennyson. "Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean. Tears from the depth of some divine despair rise in the heart and gather to the eyes in looking on the happy autumn fields and thinking of the days that are no more." I don't remember the rest. Term ends. The teacher leaves.
The poem's called Games Before Tea. A thousand eyes swirl across the green, Alibabas, albinos and Chinamen. Opalescent colours pour from fine lattice bags shut tight with a drawstring to stop out the sun. Coaxed and fussed over, the marbles roll, a prayer of protection whispered against each slithered edge as the bull bearing glints, fiendish. The best seldom appear, the small pearly blue, the colourless ones of unusual shape and size, stay deep inside, safe since their rescue from a cough sweet tin, half hidden at the back of Gran's cupboard. These are the security, precious reserve, when game after game slips away. In the long minutes before tea, one must go out in a sparkle of light.
the living room. I should say that my dad had this penchant for collecting sofas. He had this belief that we were constantly in need of a new sofa. Well, I say a new sofa, it obviously wasn't new. It was new a long time ago. So you'd come down to the room in the morning and there'd be a new sofa there. Or maybe there'd be two sofas. Here we go. The living room. Coming down to it childishly early, as a child with my child sister, a morning of condensation legs, a pillow of cat in Dad's big chair, and finding a stapler and stapling her soft little finger accidentally, and the scream. And the ever so heavily laden bookshelf that, witness to learning, collapsed yearly onto the rented black and white TV set, got originally only for the documentaries and the news and maybe the quizzes, spilling books about war in Central Africa and houseplant care, and one called You've Got to Have Love about sex on our pattern carpet, the books, that is, not the sex, a landslide of spines and pages, and a long, august line of sofas. The new, the nearly new, the second hand, the older than us, the stand-in, the temporary, the take-off-your-hands for a tenner. And the moulded cardboard bricks-and-mortar wallpaper on the chimney breast, one of 1965's really neat ideas, like the sliding partition wall that didn't, or did and made a noise like summer thunder. The room we argued over Scrabble in, the room we stayed in when we were ill, the room we were exiled to, the room we were banished from for being bad, the room they hit the roof in, the room they said we could do as we wished in, the room they broke the news to us in, the room we broke the news to them in, the room we all burst out of in, through the down-at-heel patio door, into the knee-deep garden, that warm, mild spring. The room we all went into in winter, the tiny, big, tall, short, hot, cold room, the room we left last when we left, the room we went to first when we got back.
The local cinema had been the first of our landmarks to go. With its blue and pink stucco front, it had always looked to me more like a Mexican church in a B-movie western than the Palace of Varieties it had once been. Half demolished, it became the most attractive of our ruins. It went finally at the height of summer, and for a month beforehand showed free matinees of all the films it still possessed. I went once with the Patels, twice with Farouk, and 14 times with Mrs. D. The films were unremarkable and of poor quality, and were frequently interrupted by the noise of the workmen removing the fittings. Occasionally a few of the vagrants found their way in. Most slept, but a few stayed awake to abuse the leading ladies and shout like children at whoever or whatever threatened them. The Historical Preservation Society had tried to save the cinema, but to no avail. Mrs. D ate chocolates and told me of the films she'd seen with her husbands, and when we emerged into the afternoon sunlight, she wanted to walk rather than return to the house. We were beginning to detach ourselves from it even then. I asked her if she'd seen The Alamo and pointed out the similarities. She said Kirk Douglas and absently pressed a dimple into her chin. On the day the dust finally settled on the cinema and on her reminiscences, there were children in the street with rolls of unwound film. She retrieved an empty can and kept it as a souvenir. All this was at a time before Farouk started his job at the club, when he was still working temporarily as a walking advertisement board for a promotion firms, coming home dressed as a hamburger or teapot, embarrassing us all and followed by a line of shouting children and barking dogs. He'd arrived home once as an Edam cheese with a wedge missing, from which he grinned whitely and distributed leaflets. We had to dismantle him before he could get through the front door. The red and cream-coloured pieces of cheese remained in the hallway. Mrs. D said she'd always wanted to go to Holland, to see the bulbs. She closed her eyes and hummed Tulips from Amsterdam. For his final promotion, Farouk had arrived home as a giant three-coloured ice cream cone, having walked the streets proclaiming the opening of a Neapolitan ice cream parlour in the West End. It was hot and the ice cream made him sweat. The proprietor of the Italian parlour had wanted an Italian, but Farouk came closest. He said the work was demeaning and that he was sick of posing with American tourists for photographs. I said the situation could have been much worse, but when he asked me how, I couldn't think of an answer. At the height of the summer, he'd worn the cheese and teapot and ice cream cornet with only his shorts, shoes and socks underneath. No one would let him on a bus, and it took him over an hour to walk to work, after which he walked for another 8. I'd been with Farouk to see The Sound of Music twice, and on both occasions he'd cried. He said it was uplifting to see how other people responded to adversity, and Julie Andrews usurped Doris Day as his favourite actress. With the Patels, I'd seen Bawani Junction, starring Stuart Granger and Ava Gardner. Mrs. Patel had shouted her criticisms throughout the film, and foreign voices had answered her back from the gloom. Mr. Patel tried to appear as though he were not with us. She shouted at the slightest excuse, and there were times when she seemed almost to be providing a running commentary for the voices in the dark. Her husband said she had always been public-spirited and tried to cover his ears. At the end of the film, Mrs. Patel stood up and applauded. Mr. Patel said we should never have come and tried to usher her out. We stood outside in the vivid light and heat and rubbed our eyes. Mrs. Patel reenacted several of Ava Gardner's scenes, and her husband stiffened with embarrassment. She wanted to go again, but he said he could not afford to spend any more time away from the shop. On the way home, we had encountered Farouk as a walking hamburger. He walked in the gutter beside us, constantly wiping the sweat from his face and flicking it to the ground. Mrs. D had seen Ava Gardner in Two Girls and a Sailor and Mogambo. Farouk was unable to turn his head. He waited for her to finish before asking to be dismantled. Mrs. D said something obvious about him bringing his work home with him and laughed. Farouk ran a cold bath and sat in it for an hour. He swore every evening to resign, but set out each morning oozing sauce and mustard and thinking only of the money. He said that without the job he would have no self-respect. He rose from the teapot, its lid a wide sombrero on his head. There was just room inside for him to move his arms and a slot in the spout through which he distributed leaflets.
Start with a poem called Beyond Accepted Bounds. You have plenty of imperfections and several flaws, but I wish well towards you. I'm talking about us, not about etymology or communication with the spirits of the dead. You and me, and an affair that could go beyond the usual bounds. Things have started to get mellow, to assume positions I would have assigned them had I been some petty master of ceremonies in a scheme of life. And then again, when the mould lies an inch or so thick on the jam I prefer, when oranges decay and apples wrinkle to little more than cud, then I don't worry over much either. I stick right in and attempt to hold to the sway of things. Then I feel whatever it is pelting through the core of the lot of us. It's what some people might term ordained or holy. I just call it feeling part of the supreme being. But it's then that with every breath I get up and place myself in the centre of Europe.
This is a poem which was written when I discovered that Bernie Winters had died. Or as the BBC News had it, the comedian Bernie Winters. A subtle difference, possibly. And it's called Hot News from a Cold Place. Bernie Winters is dead and Lenny Summers is in mourning. Nobody has written an obituary for Bernie Winters. Tears and laughter, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. There is not going to be a Bernie Winters retrospective on TV and Lenny Summers is in mourning. They're not repeating even one of the Tonight with Bernie Winters TV shows, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. Bernie Winters had a brother, the closeness of family, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. My Life with Bernie Winters is out of print, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. Bernie Winters is dead, and Johnny Thunders, and the World of Variety substantially diminished, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. Man of Laughter, Man of Tears will not now be made. Bernie Winters is dead, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. Corridors to Possible Worlds, The Smiling Variety, Bernie Winters, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. No More a Million Smiles, Bernie Winters, Worry Hardly at All, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. My 500 Best Gags by Bernie Winters, Seasons of Passing, Time flieth like an arrow by day through sunlight and cloud in imagination, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. Bernie Winters is dead, doors closing, doors opening, and Lenny Summers is in mourning. Bernie Winters.
And it was on a Sunday evening that the crisis occurred that led to his final, unlamented disappearance. Rocky was on the table, admiring himself in his mirror, which Jessica had propped up against a cup. Fat Alan had taken the cage to the sink in order to scrub it out. It had been a lot of years since Fat Alan had seen his own feet while standing on them. With a birdcage balanced on his 10-pint punch, he'd no chance. He turned from the sink, and at the same instant, Rocky, tired of pecking at his reflection, fluttered down to the floor. They met before the bird could even begin his recital. He did not receive Fat Alan's full 13 stone, because Fat Alan felt him through the thin sole of his slipper and drew back. But it was an uneven contest. All three of them stared for a moment in horror at the writhing bundle of blue on the linoleum. Then Jessica picked it up. "Is wee heart still beating?" she said. "It's like a wee train, sort of." But the neck was clearly broken, and within a minute or two, the gallant thumps had faltered, gathered pace, faltered again, and stopped. Fat Alan felt them staring at him, his wife, his daughter, and the hovering, vengeful soul of the dead budgie. And his face grew red, and tears welled up in his eyes as he wound himself up for the offensive. "My bird! My poor wee bird! I was used bitches! Training him to walk in the fucking flower!" "Training him?" said Big Jessie, in a scornful, "here we go again" tone. "Training him? What the bloody hell do you own about? You're the only man that's trained him. You and that stupid box and that stupid John L. Stupid fucking Sullivan. We never trained him nothing. It was you that trained him." "Aye, and he only learned two of them anyway," said Jessica, who was beginning to cry but was enjoying her father's guilt. "We never trained him nothing," Big Jessie repeated. "He's dead, saw it. He's dead. You should have learned the wee bastard to stay up high like a real bird. For Christ's sake, birds are not supposed to run about the fucking flare." "Oh, shut up, you big stumer. Nobody learned him that. He learned that himself." While they argued, young Jessica smoothed the feathers of the corpse. There was a pause while Fat Alan fished around for other culprits, other offences, and she looked up. "We'll need to bury him. Where we cross, maybe. You've killed him, da." This, the direct accusation, was too much for Fat Alan. "Jesus Christ! What have I just been saying? It wasn't me that killed the wee bastard. It was yous. What would I want to kill him for? He's my wee champion, Christ. I've been teaching him to speak." "I don't believe this. I really don't." Big Jessica was pointing at the floor, where a few small feathers stood out, clean and blue, against the faded brown linoleum. "We've just seen you stunning in the wee bugger, haven't we?" "That's immaterial, immaterial. Yous were the cause of it." "Ah," she said, shaking her head. "Don't listen to him, Jessica Hen. He's just a heed case. He's pure mental. Come on, we'll bury the wee thing down the back." "Hey, hold your fucking horses," Fat Alan interrupted. "He's my bird. It's me that buries him. And who do you think you're calling mental?" "Who do you think? Well, I only see one bam potter in here. And it's no me, and it's no the Wayne, And it's no that wee bird. So there! He considered punching, considered slapping, considered strangling. But Big Jesse was a match for him. And there was blood in his slipper.
Are there any Freemasons here? It's for you. It's called instant enlightenment. I've been hanging round at the Masonic Lodge very furtively indeed now for 5.5 days. Not even a sly nod or wink to misinterpret. Just a disaffected cleaner who says nothing. Do I have to be a policeman? Is there an application form? And if there's to be some exotic initiation, I want to get some practice in. Start biting the heads off live chickens. Start cutting up my body, writing code words with my blood. I want a Mason's uniform. I want a Mason's uniform. I want a Mason's uniform. I need to belong. I need to be at the helm of something deep and mystical. Yes, I know about the handshake. Somebody knows, somebody knows, somebody knows, somebody knows someone's dad said they found one of their handbooks in their shattered attic. Dead weird, very esoteric. Apparently they speak in a frail, disjointed language. It's just no good. It's just no good how I aspire to Masonhood. But hold on, how can I be 100% sure?
And the last one is
simply called water. Water. It changes things. Just look at what the sea does to pebbles and bricks and fragments of glass. Even the rock of this mountain before us gets worn and worried by generations of rain. Bit by bit, the streams below are carting it away to the sea. The sea, as we know, has mountains of its own. Its briny work is never done. Every day it sends more clouds to remind us how things must change.